The world has become a huge babbling sphere of mainly nonsense. I sometimes think that social media should be really called social incontinence. People imagine that because we can speak, that we have something to say. And that's not always the case.
That's John Banville. For 50 years, he has meticulously crafted words into some of the greatest prose ever written in the English language. So it's no wonder that he has little tolerance for a world increasingly filled with words carelessly tossed about. John Banville talks about his reverence for the sentence, for Ireland, and for rain on today's episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
It's John Banville's view that artists are born or create themselves. No one can teach you to be an artist, in other words. And thank God for that, he says. Otherwise, the world would be full of artists. And imagine that. Banville's novels include The Book of Evidence, Ancient Light, and the Revolutions trilogy, which imagined the lives of three scientists, Copernicus, Kepler, and Newton. His 2005 novel, The Sea, won one of the most prestigious international literary awards, the Man Booker Prize. He's written 18 novels and plays and memoirs, and then there are the 10 popular crime novels he's also written under the pseudonym Benjamin Black. In conversation, John Banville has a penchant for quoting the wisdom and wit of other artists, though he's got plenty of his own to spare. He's also got a penchant for speaking in an intimate whisper, forcing you to pay close attention. So tune out the noise around you as best you can and lean on in. You won't want to miss what he had to say to Washington Post reporter Mary Jordan in the fall of 2017 when she sat down with him at the Academy of Achievement Summit in London to talk about his approach to writing.
I'm not very good on paragraphs, but I'm not too bad on sentences. And each sentence generates the next one. If you get a sentence as close to being perfect as you can, which is still pretty far away from perfect, but it's as close as you can get, and that generates the next one. And I trust the sentence to create characters, to make a plot, to carry me along. Anyway, what's the point of a plot? You know, has life got a plot? Not that I know of. So why should novels have a plot? But it has to have some kind of story, it has to have some kind of structure.
This sentence, in the sea, I can't forget. You said, the past beats inside me like a second heart. Now, that's an Irish sentence.
It's absolutely extraordinary. That is the one sentence that everybody remembers from my books. I don't know why. It hit some chord. It took me about 10 seconds to write. I didn't even think about it. But for some reason, it just lodges with people. I don't think it's particularly Irish. We all live in the past. The present doesn't exist.
How do you know when you have a sentence close to perfect that people will read and read over and over again? How do you know?
Well, the facile answer is that I've got it to a point where I'm just sick of it. I want to get rid of it. But I think the better answer is that, and when I was a teenager, I tried for a few years to be a painter. No talent whatsoever. But it did teach me some painterly lessons. And one is that And I think all painters know this. I've heard them speak of it. That you get a painting to a certain point, even an abstract painting, and you know that if you apply one more piece of colour, the whole thing will just turn to mud. And I think it's the same with the sentence. Get to a point where I know if I keep fiddling with this, it will die, it'll go dead, it'll become dull.
Banville has a lot to say about the sentence. In fact, before we go on with more from his conversation with Mary Jordan, I want to play you a talk he gave about the sentence, you could call it a homily, to students and dignitaries at the Academy of Achievement Summit in London. Then we'll pick back up with the conversation.
Humankind's most momentous invention is the sentence. There have been great civilizations that didn't have the concept of the wheel, but they had to have the sentence. For without it, they would have been neither great nor civilized. It's with the sentence that we think, speculate, calculate, imagine. It is with the sentence that we declare love, declare war, declare oaths. It is with the sentence that we declare the self. Our laws are written in sentences. One might go so far as to say that it is in sentences that our very world itself is written, even if sometimes very ill-written. Others will make other claims. The scientists will say that the invention of mathematics is our supreme achievement as a species. And it is true the language of mathematics is a thing of sublime beauty. Its great strength is its rigor. However, the great strength of the sentence, and by extension language, is that rigor is precisely, gloriously what it lacks. No matter how clear, direct, and simple a sentence is, it will always be at some level ambiguous, and the essence of life is ambiguity. The language of sentences wraps itself around reality in an endless effort to encompass it, to comprehend it, to express it. The effort is in vain, as it must be. Ultimate reality is ultimately beyond us. There is no such thing as the thing in itself. There are only relations between things. All is contingency. As Emerson beautifully says, we live amid surfaces, and the true art of life is to skate well on them. Language, we may think, cuts no ice, but it does cut wonderful figures. As writers, we hone our sentences so that we might cleave through to the quick of things. They will not. We are too humanly slow. Yet we go on trying to say it, trying to get it said, trying to get it right. We should not succeed, but our glory is, as my fellow countryman Samuel Beckett knew, that we carry on, undaunted, but never quite defeated. And the effort is not in vain, even though every full stop is an admission of failure. To speak is to be. As the great poet Rilke, in his Duino Elegies, put it, he put it as well as it's ever been put. Are we perhaps here just for saying, house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, fruit tree, window, possibly pillar, tower? But for saying, remember, oh, for such saying as never the things themselves hoped so intensely to be. I have spent my life wrestling with sentences. I cannot imagine a more privileged existence. Thank you.
John Irving said that he starts a book with the last sentence and works his way back. How do you begin?
With the first sentence. It begins as a kind of tension in space. You know, there's something out there and it's waiting for the big bang. You know, and I have to get that into my head. It's beautifully, I have a composer friend in Ireland and he put it beautifully. He said, I have this scream in my head and I have to get it into the orchestra, I have to get it into the music. And I wouldn't be quite as dramatic as that. But I have this tension, I have this thing that has to be done. The first paragraph is the absolute, for me, it's the essential. One of my books, I can't remember which, I spent, I think 3, maybe 4 months writing the first paragraph. Sometimes I was just writing it out, same paragraph, trying to get the tone, because tone is everything. Now, don't ask me to explain what tone is, but I have to hear the voice. And every novel has its own voice and its own tone. Once you get that, then you're going. And curiously, it has a lot to do with getting the names of the characters right. If you go through Henry James' notebooks, you see long lists of names, possible names. Now, how do you know a character's name is right? You don't. But somehow it makes a chime. It just sounds, it feels right. And that is very important for me.
Do you read your paragraph over and over again so that you can hear the chime?
Yes, I have this very rich poetic voice that I hear myself reading in. I do a sort of cadence, you know, chanting it. I'm not aware of doing it. That's for the rhythm. You have to get, I mean, rhythm is almost as important as tone. I mean, I've been planning for the past week, I've been planning, writing and rewriting the first sentence of my next book over and over again. I sent my wife 3 separate versions of it by email last night, asking her which sounds best. And I'll be doing that for weeks and weeks and weeks. But when I get that sentence right, then I'll know that I can get going on the first paragraph. When I get the first paragraph as near to right as I can get it, then I'll be on my way.
What's your favorite sentence you've ever written?
The next one. The one that I write next. That'll be my favorite.
You know, a lot of people, when your work is studied at universities and a lot of places, and many people talk about the sense of place, that's really comes alive in your work. Is that how you would describe it? I mean,
Well, I try to have a sense of immediacy. It seems to me that the only reason to make a work of art is to try to make the reader or the listener or the viewer feel, taste, hear, smell the world as it is. But of course, we don't do it as it is. A novel is nothing like the world and nothing like life, but it produces a wonderful simulacrum of it, strangely compelling parallel version of the world that people think is real. You know, I wrote a book once about Johannes Kepler, the great astronomer, and who lived in the 1600s, and people said to me, how well I'd caught the period. And I was too polite to say to them, how do you know? But they were giving me a wonderful compliment. They were saying, you have created something here that looks and sounds and smells to me what I imagine the 1600s were like. So that's all we can do, is give... It's kind of glorified, transcendental lying. That's what fiction is.
And why do you love that?
I love telling lies. I love making stories. I love interpreting the world. This is why I started to write, in order to interpret the world to myself. Because I didn't understand it, I found it baffling. I found the world baffling.
The only reason that we're not constantly surprised by the world is because, Banville says, quoting Samuel Beckett, habit is a great deadener.
But the sky is an extraordinary phenomenon. You look up and you're looking into infinity. And then the clouds come along. Clouds are the most amazing things. The sea is amazing. It's flat. Everything else in the world is, you know, up and down. The sea is flat. And you walk along the land and you come to this extraordinary flat phenomenon. Never ceases to baffle me.
When did you first think, I want to be a writer?
I think I was about 12 or 13, and my sister gave me a copy of James Joyce's story collection, Dubliners. And I was amazed to discover that fiction could be about life as I knew it. You know, here was writing that wasn't a crime novel or a school yarn or a Wild West story. This was about ordinary, grey life. But by the power of imagination and the power of language, Joyce showed the ordinary to be utterly extraordinary as it is. Joyce said, and I agree with him, he said, I've never met an ordinary person, nor am I.
Were there a lot of books in your house? Both your siblings are also writers. What were you drinking over at your house?
Yeah, it wasn't a big reading household, no. My mother read magazines, my father read Wild West stories. You see, it was a small town, it was a bleak time, late 50s, early 60s. Everything arrives 20 years later in Ireland, so the 60s arrived in the 80s for us. So it was I needed to escape from the world that I lived in, but I also needed to enter into it, and writing allowed me to do both.
You grew up right after the war in a poor Ireland. Well, I mean, tell us about your early childhood. What was that like?
Well, W.H. Auden said that an artist should be loaded with, in childhood, should be loaded with as much trauma as he can bear, because it will do him good in later life. I was misfortunate and I had a happy childhood, at least when I look back on it. It seems to have been happy. Boring, of course. I mean, I regard childhood as a complete waste of time. My own children, I told them to grow up as quickly as they could and stop all this nonsense, stop. Apart from anything else, children just pretend to be children to save the embarrassment of adults. We know everything by the time we're 9, 10, 11. Yeah, you know, the rest is just refinement, the rest is detail. But we know it all by then. But we pretend we don't, so that our parents won't be embarrassed.
But you didn't go on to university, did you?
No, my mother said to me, if you want to do this artistic stuff, why don't you become an architect? At least then you get a job and make money. So to please her, I went along for a little while with the notion of being an architect, but I had no gift whatsoever for architecture. I knew what I wanted to do. And I wanted to get away from home, and I wanted to travel.
And why did you want to get away from home?
Doesn't every child want to get away from home? I want to start one's own life. And we're completely callous when we're young. We just walk away from our parents, you know, as if, oh, don't bother me anymore. Which, of course, I feel horribly guilty about now that it's much too late. But I wanted to be free. I wanted to be free. And I went to work for the airline for Aer Lingus because that was the way to travel. I had a job as a clerk, which was not interesting in any way, but the travel was superb. I mean, I remember taking a flight first class, Lufthansa, direct from London to San Francisco for £2. So here was a wonderful way to travel. So I got to go to Paris, I got to go to Rome, I got to go to Greece, I got to go to America. It was wonderful.
Did the travel help you in your writing in any way?
Well, I imagine that it showed me something of a wider world. Although now, the age I am now, I think that travel narrows the mind.
Wow.
I think one should stay at home. I have a plan that when I finally give up this writing business, I will become a travel agent. And my travel agency, the stipulation will be that you cannot travel more than 20 miles from where you live. So you have to have your holiday where you live.
But you loved your travel around the world.
Of course I did.
But what are you really saying? You think people should, at this time in our lives, or is there a certain time to stay home?
My daughter works as a tour guide in Paris, and she said the one thing I've discovered is that 99.9% of people do not want to be on holiday. It's the last thing they want to be doing. They don't speak the language. They don't like the people in the country they're in. The food sickens them. They want to be home. They miss their kids. They should stay at home.
What is it about Ireland that has produced, for such a small island, so many writers?
Well, I have a theory, this is my pet theory, and I'll be as brief as I can. We lost the Irish language in the middle of the 19th century, during the period of the famine, in the 1840s. We did this extraordinary thing of giving up Irish and moving to English. It never happened anywhere else before.
It wasn't really voluntary.
Well, it was, because we gave it up. we decided as a people, we didn't make an agreement, we didn't have a consensus, but we just quietly gave it up and took on English. But the English that we took on was like the Latin of the Roman Empire. It's a language of command, of narrative, of plain speech, of direct speech. Whereas the Irish language is a very oblique, very poetic medium. And I often think of the Irish language as a mode of evasion rather than of communication. And when you put those two together, you get this strange new language, which is a marvellous literary medium. And I think it's because of the richness of this language that we have that we produce so many Anglo-Irish writers.
Is it the words? Is it the way it's put together? What is different about it?
Well, we love ambiguity. George Orwell said that prose should be a pane of glass that you look through at what's being said. For us, language is a lens, and lenses distort. They get you closer to the thing, but they do distort. But they're also very highly polished. So that's what we did with the English language. We took it and rejoiced in it. There's a pun.
Take a minute to rejoice in the written words of John Banville. Here is the opening paragraph from his 2005 Booker Prize-winning novel, The Sea. It's the story of a man who contends with the death of his wife and with a shocking event in his childhood by returning to his family's summer home.
They departed, the gods, on the day of the strange tide. All morning, under a milky sky, the waters in the bay had swelled and swelled, rising to unheard of heights, the small waves creeping over parched sand that for years had known no wetting save for rain and lapping the very bases of the dunes. The rusted hulk of the freighter that had run aground at the far end of the bay longer ago than any of us could remember must have thought it was being granted a relaunch. I would not swim again after that day. The seabirds mewed and swooped, unnerved, it seemed, by the spectacle of that vast bowl of water bulging like a blister, lead blue and malignantly agleam. They looked unnaturally white that day, those birds. The waves were depositing a fringe of soiled yellow foam along the waterline. No sail marred the high horizon. I would not swim, no, not ever again. Someone has just walked over my grave. Someone.
How long did you work on that beautiful paragraph?
Long time. Weeks, months. Months, maybe.
And when was the moment you knew, I don't have to edit this anymore?
Well, I got so sick of it that I couldn't face it, working on it anymore. So I gave it up. That's what we do, you know, you just give it up. Paul Valéry said, work of art is never finished, only abandoned.
When you read it now, do you like it?
No, I hate all my work. It embarrasses me. All I see are the faults. Gary Larson has a wonderful cartoon in two parts. The top part is a flower bed, and the flowers are absolutely beautiful. It says how people see flowers. And in the second half, they've all got cross-eyed and snaggle teeth. The caption is how flowers see themselves. Well, that's how I see my writing, cross-eyed and snaggle-tooth.
Do you think it keeps you working harder for the next one?
Oh, yes, as my wife said once, you know, if you get it right, you'd stop, and then what would you do? Go into politics, and God help us all.
Do you have an interest in politics?
No, but the ego of the writer is so enormous. And look at the 20th century, all the great monsters, they were all failed artists. Hitler wanted to be a painter, Stalin wanted to be a poet, Mao wanted to be a poet, Pol Pot wanted to be a poet. Nothing more dangerous than a failed artist.
You were saying you didn't have a gift for architecture. What did anyone, do you remember the first time somebody said to you, you have a gift for writing?
God, no.
Did your parents ever
say that? No, my mother, I don't think, ever read anything that I wrote. And I didn't mind that, I understood it. I think she was afraid of what she would find. My father read some, but...
What did he say?
He thought it was quite good. But my parents were simple people, very clever, not well educated. My mother was like Irina in Chekhov's Three Sisters. She longed to go to Moscow. Moscow for her being Dublin. And at the end of her life, she moved to Dublin. And of course, it wasn't Moscow. It wasn't even Dublin. It was a dream. And you should never move to your dream place. So I felt pretty sorry for her.
Sounds so dark, never move to your dream place. Do you really believe that?
Yes. Keep the dream. A young man once phoned up Ava Gardner in her old age and said, no, Rita Hayworth, it was Rita Hayworth. He said, I would really love to meet you. I think you're the most beautiful woman in the world. And she said, I'm not now. Keep the dream.
It's not clear whether there is some dream place for Banville outside of his beloved Ireland. He did live for a time in Berkeley, California in 1968. That's where he met his future wife. They moved for a year to London, where he finished his first book, and then they decided to live in Ireland for a year or two. That was almost 50 years ago.
I can't write anywhere else. I need the Irish climate, which is the most wonderful climate in the world. Don't let people are constantly complaining about it. It's a marvelous climate. I think it's the light. The light is so beautiful in Ireland. It has this pearly sheen to it. Even in high summer, in the odd days when the sun shines, it still has that lovely, steely, pearly shade that I cannot do without. The only other city I've ever come across the same light as in Copenhagen. But I love it, and I...
Does the rain figure into your writing?
Oh, I love rain. Rain is the most extraordinary phenomenon. When it rains, we should be out cheering. Water falls from the sky. Isn't that a miracle? You know, just you're walking along, suddenly water is falling on you. And it's making things grow. And it's washing the streets. After a time of drought, you can see the trees. You know, when rain falls, you can see the trees just drinking it in. It's wonderful to watch, springtime especially.
Do you have a daily routine? Do you like to write in the morning? Do you like in the afternoon? Do you write all day?
No, I keep office hours. I work from 9:30 to 6. Morning, you just, you know, you write for maybe 3 hours, but you're still just preparing. But about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one has sunk to such a level of concentration that I don't know who I am. Time expands and contracts. And that's where you really concentrate. You forget yourself. You forget your surroundings. You forget everything.
Do you have a special place where you write your best?
I have my studio, which is pretty well windowless.
Why is it windowless if you love the light?
Oh, I love the light when I'm walking about in it, but I couldn't look at a view when I'm writing.
Why?
Because it would be too distracting. It's a terrible life in a way. We're inhuman, you know, we're cannibals. We eat our children. We would exchange our children for a good sentence. We're monsters.
Writing is such a solitary endeavor. Is it hard work for you?
It's immensely hard work, but what's the point of doing easy work? It's immensely rewarding, it's immensely infuriating. And painful and horrifying at times. I remember when I was doing one of my books, it was giving me such trouble that I sat down in a chair one day, couldn't do any more. And I actually had a vision of myself writhing in pain on the floor. So it's terribly, terribly difficult. But anything worthwhile doing is always difficult.
When you do take a break from writing, what do you do?
Never do. I write 24 hours a day, even when I'm asleep, especially when I'm asleep. I mean, we all write when we're asleep. As Nietzsche said, every man's an artist when he sleeps. They make up these fantastical worlds, people you've never met, places you've never been to, things you've never done. And for the period that you're dreaming them, they're absolutely real. Extraordinary phenomenon.
You're so often described as an imaginative writer. Is there something that you do to help stoke that?
Imagine being described as a non-imaginative writer. No, I just, as I said at the start, I just find the world incomprehensible. And I think I've fixed on writing as a way to try to explain it to myself. Well, not to explain it, to account for the world to myself.
Do you have other friends that you talk to about writing?
No. Writers never talk about writing. Writers only talk about money and how dreadful their agent is and how badly their publisher is treating them. That's all we ever talk. That's why writers are so boring.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone say writers are boring, especially you.
Well, they're boring company. And then, you know, we all hate each other, you know, we're all jealous of each other. I remember the first time I met Martin Amis, I was coming over to London. I wrote to him and said, let's have lunch. This was a long time ago, 35 years ago. And we met, and two not very tall men, you know, sizing each other up. We met in a little restaurant in Ladbroke Grove. We started polite conversation. I said, look, Martin, let's stop this. You hate me and I hate you, right? If you win a prize, I hate you. If you get, you know, a rave review, I hate you. Same with me. Martin said, you know you're right. And we've been friends ever since.
But you were just being cheeky.
No, we do hate each other. Nobody's more jealous than writers, artists. And they're always saying dreadful things about each other. My favorite at the moment is somebody asked Braque about his old friend Picasso when they were both old. And Braque said, Pablo used to be a good painter. Now he's just a genius. Isn't that wonderful?
Who are your favorite writers?
Well, the ones I admire most would be Henry James. I think he was the greatest novelist of all. I can't talk about present-day people because it would be invidious. You know, if I mention one, I have to mention them all. In Irish writing, I think that certainly people of my generation, we went either the Joyce route or we went the Beckett route. You know, Joyce put everything in, Beckett took everything out. And you have to choose one or the other.
And you chose?
I chose Beckett. But Beckett's writing is much richer than... I don't know why people think of Beckett as bleak. He's also one of the funniest writers that ever wrote. Superbly funny.
Since you're always striving to do something you haven't done before, what is still left on the table that you want to do?
Oh, all kinds of things. All kinds of things. I've just written a sequel to Henry James' The Portrait of a Lady. Just been published. I'm also writing under my pseudonym of my disgraceful twin, Benjamin Black. I'm writing an erotic mystery set in Venice in 1900.
Let's talk about Benjamin Black. First of all...
Do we have to talk about him?
A little bit. Why did you pick Benjamin Black? You could have... You know, picked Stuart Parnell or...
I picked Benjamin White because he was a character in one of my early novels that I'm glad to say nobody reads anymore. And my publishers, my agents, said, we think Black is better. You know, it sounds better, it looks better if you're going to write mystery stories. Also, it'll be much higher up the librarian's purchase list.
Because it's alphabetical?
Because it's alphabetical, BB.
So, for the sake of comparison, take a listen to the opening passage from Benjamin Black's recent novel, Wolf on a String, read by actor Simon Vance for the audiobook. The story begins in Prague in the winter of 1599. The narrator, a young scholar and alchemist.
Few now recall that it was I who discovered the corpse of Dr. Kroll's misfortunate daughter, thrown upon the snow that night in Golden Lane. The fickle muse of history has all but erased the name of Christian Stern from her timeless pages, Yet often I have had cause to think how much better it would have been for me had it never been written there in the first place. I was to soar high on gorgeous plumage, but in the end fell back to earth with wings ablaze. It was the heart of winter, and a crescent moon hung crookedly over the bulk of Hradčany Castle, looming above the narrow laneway where the body lay.
So, can you talk about when John Banville writes a literary novel and Benjamin Black writes crime fiction? Do you wake up in the morning and you say, I think I'll be Benjamin Black today?
No. When I started being Benjamin Black, I thought I'd be Benjamin Black in the morning and I'd be Banville in the afternoon, but it didn't work.
So you write straight through?
You see, it takes me 2, 3, 4, 5 years to write a Banville book, so I have to interrupt it. I detest summer. Summer is the most boring season of all. I really hate it. So I kill the summer by writing about Benjamin Black novel. And then I spend the rest of the year being Banville.
Let's go back for a second. Summer is the loveliest time of the year to most people. Why do you think it's horrid?
Because it's dead. Nothing's happened. The leaves are green, and then they're green, and then they start to turn grey, and the earth just sits there doing nothing. In autumn, you know, the place just goes into mad colour, even in Ireland. Spring is too disturbing. It's too, you know, gets the blood going, which is not good if you're sitting in a room for 8 hours a day writing. Winter, you can feel the ground quaking as all that potential life is just getting ready to come up in the spring. These are the wonderful seasons. Whereas summer is just summer. People are going on holiday. I hate holidays. They're no fun at all for me. I want to be at home. To enjoy a holiday, you have to not enjoy your life. And I love my life, so why do I want to go away from it?
But you've had massive success. You've won all these prizes. Can't you just take it easy now?
Well, I'd melt. And now I've come to an age where I keep waiting to the day when I will forget a word. And I'll have forgotten it in such a way that I know it's gone. And then I know dementia is coming on. Maybe then I'll give up. I might go back to painting then. Maybe I discover that I wasn't too bad after all. But there's a wonderful story of Henry James when he was dying. He was in a coma. His hand was moving across the sheet. He was still writing. That'll be me. Writing till I, you know, I fall off the edge.
What advice would you give to a young writer that feels that this is what they want to do?
I think all advice is useless because nobody ever takes it, and quite right too. But my own mottos are, don't imagine for a moment that you're going to be able to express yourself. That's not what art is at all. And most aspiring artists think, I have something to say. My friend the novelist, Will Self, has a wonderful witticism. He said, it's true, every man has a novel in him, only he shouldn't write it. I have two mottos, one from Kafka. The artist is the one who has nothing to say. Okay? And the other is from one of the ancient Romans, Cato the Censor, who had a wonderful, he said, rem tene verbum sequentur, grasp the object and the words will follow. And that's, don't think about what you think about the world. Don't think about your feelings or your emotions or your aspirations. Think about the object. The poet Rilke, one of the great poets, 20th century, when he was young, he worked briefly for Rodin, the sculptor. Rodin said to him, you know, you're much too precious. Tell you what you'll do. You go to the Jardin des Plantes, go to the zoo, pick an animal and spend a day. He said, just sit on a bench, watch that animal. then go away and write a poem about it. And it was one of the first of Rilke's great masterpieces, The Panther. Very short poem, but it's absolutely perfect because it's not about Rilke's feelings or anything else. It's about the panther's feelings and what it's like to be a panther. Because that's what art is. Art is what objects are in themselves, not what you are. I have nothing to say.
Novelist John Banville, and for that matter, novelist Benjamin Black, speaking to Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement. We've profiled many authors on this podcast, and each one has had really fascinating insights into the writing process. So be sure to check out other episodes in our back catalog. You can also find dozens of writers featured on the Academy's website, achievement.org. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you've heard, please leave us a comment and tell a friend. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes. Funding for What It Takes comes from the Katherine B. Reynolds Foundation.